mention before we begin this evening, this year will be the final year for the current series. We'll take a break, a three-week break. That's our nod to the yeshivas Bein Hazmanim. And we will resume with Mitzvah Hashem the Monday of Parsha Shoftim, which is the 2nd of Elul, also the 2nd of September. That's when we will resume. As we say, if in the break Mashiach comes, please be in touch with Jenny, and we'll see how the arrangements go for this year. I hope this can continue regardless. We're doing a good thing. So this week is Parshas Devarim, and as we sometimes do, if it's the last Parsha, we never get to the ones in between. We sometimes take an advance on a later Parsha, and I would like to devote some comments to Parshas Akev, which will be in 2 weeks' time, before we move on to Inyan Diyoma. I am mindful of the fact that we have never, in our 23 years, had a shir on Parshas Re'eh, so that is owing. But in the meanwhile, to Parshas Akev. Akev, of course, has many, many parts to it, but I would like to focus on just a couple of psukim and begin in Perek Ches, Pasuk Ches, which is the pasuk of the famous Shivas Haminim. And we know the words very well. Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jewish people, you are entering, he speaks to them about the land, and as he describes it in Pasuk Ches, of Perek Ches, Eretz Chita U'Sora, it's a land of wheat, barley, v'gefen, vines, v'te'ena, figs, v'rimon, pomegranates, Eretz Shemen Udavash, a land of oil producing olives and honey. And the honey here, as we know, is not the honey of bees and flowers, but it's honey from dates. These then are the Shivas Haminim. And there's much to say about the Shivas Haminim, but of course, we note that in this pasuk, in listing them, the word Eretz is stated twice. First, at the beginning of the pasuk, Eretz, Klita, Usora, etc. And then again, towards the end, before the number 6 and 7, Eretz, Zeis Shemen, Udevash. And the question, of course, is what to make of these two Eretzes. They could have been listed from 1 to 7 without interruption. Why does the Torah give us another Eretz? Now, interestingly, one of the answers, the halachic answer to this question, actually relates to the halachas of brachos. Because there is a major discussion when one chooses which food to eat first or which fruit to eat first. So Shivas Haminim trumps everything else. And within the Shivas Haminim, which one should choose? If you've got pomegranates and dates and figs, where does one start? And the answer that the Gemara gives is that you start, this is in Maseches Brachos and Daf Mem Aleph, you choose the fruit that is closest to an Eretz. The closer it is to a mentioning of the word Eretz in the Pasuk, that's your choice. And interestingly, what that means practically is that if there are dates there, you'll choose the dates because numbers 1 and 2 of the first Eretz is wheat and barley, that's mazonos, which is, but if you wish to make a ha'etz, so then after wheat and barley is gefen, te'ina, v'rimon, but there's number 3, 4, and 5. But the olives and the dates are numbers 1 and 2 before the second Eretz. And therefore, the closer it is to an Eretz, the more that will be the one to make the bracha. That is why, not to get too far ahead in the year, but this comes a bit of practical relevance on Rosh Hashanah night, when people have their simonim, and there's all sorts of fruits, and there's all sorts of everything. And according to Shlomo Zalman Orbach, the ha'etz should be made on dates, because they're from Shivas Haminim, and their dates is one of the simonim, sheyitamu sonenu, and they're closest to Eretz, they should lead the simonim. Many people don't do that. They make the bracha on the apple, and there's explanations as to why that would be. But in any case, these are the halachic ramifications of the two mentions of the word Eretz. They're the points of reference. The closer one gets to them, and the sooner the fruit is mentioned after them, the more it will have precedence for brachos. In fact, this is the classic test that is given to prospective suitors. When the chassan meets the in-laws, they offer him a platter of food. It's not to be sure that perhaps he's hungry, but to be sure that he knows his halachas. And that's his first test, trial by fruit. And he has to know, survey the scene, and detect which is the one he should make the bracha of ha'etz. My advice to Talmidim in a situation like this, if they find themselves confused, they should refuse all food, claiming that they are fasting for the success of the shidduch. In any case, so these are the halachas of the two eretzim. But of course, that is not a pshat answer. And moreover, we're mindful of the fact that the entire institution of brachas before food is derabbanan. So although the rabbanon are taking their cue from this pasuk, we will certainly be entitled to search for an answer al derech hapshat. Why is there another eretz in the pasuk before numbers 6 and 7? And Meshech Chachma addresses this question, and he says a chiddush. From various psukim, it appears, says Meshech Chachma, that olives and dates were not known to the generation that left Mitzrayim. That means, as we know, sometimes the pshat of a pasuk, although the halacha is ledoros, halacha is for all time, but the specific way that it's phrased, al derech hapshat, has particular relevance to that generation to whom is it addressed. And here too, the first five, they were familiar with them. Chito, Sa'ora, Gef, and Te'ina for Rimon. But then there's another eretz because there are two new fruits. That's why they're almost like in a category on their own for the door that never yet saw Eretz Yisrael, only had experienced them or their parents in Eretz Mitzrayim. Why do I say this? Says Meshech Chachma. What is the indication? It comes from a couple of very interesting places. If we go back to Parshas Chukas, the prelude to the Meimeriva, to the whole episode with the rock, not only did the people complain that there was no water, which of course they did, Miriam died, no water, and that led into that episode, but they also say, why did you bring us here? Lo makom zera, it's not a place where you can sow things. B'te'ena v'gefen v'rimon, there's no figs here. There's no grapes here, there's no pomegranates here, and there's no water. So they list off all the fruits that they're missing, that are absent. Ask Meshech Chachma, why'd you stop the list short? I mean, as they say in modern Hebrew, im kvar, as kvar. You start the list, finish it. It's not a place where anything grows. So why just mention Te'ena, Gefen, Rimon? What about Zesim and Tamarim? They're also missing. It's a desert, nothing grows. Says Meshech Chachma, that's what we're saying. It appears that they didn't notice these things were missing because they had no experience of those two fruits. But they know those other three, Gefen, Te'ena, V'rimon. And therefore, that's the first indication. Very interesting that they had no encounters with those other two fruits. They couldn't complain about them missing. It's also interesting with regards to dates, date honey. If we go back to Chumash Bereishis, I mean, it's an entirely different way of learning the Parshas. Go back to Chumash Bereishis, in Parshas Miketz, when Shimon has been held in Mitzrayim, Yaakov doesn't want to send anyone down, doesn't want to send Binyamin down, but in the end he relents, and he says, so when you go back, take gifts. Kechumi Zimras Ha'aretz. What is Zimras Ha'aretz? Rashi says, Miloshon Zemiras, people praise them, take the things that everyone knows you can get in Eretz Yisrael, and it's famous for them, perhaps you can't get them anywhere else. I recall actually, but just before I came to learn in Eretz Yisrael, my father, Zichron Levracha, who was very musical, as those of you who knew him would know, and he said that when you go to yeshiva, aside from all your learning, kechumi zimras haaretz, bring back some zemiras from Eretz Yisrael. I'd like to hear what they're singing over there. But, so, take some special fruits from Eretz Yisrael. And one of the things that he mentions, Ma'at Dvash takes some date honey. And once again, it sounds like it was something of a delicacy from Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't have it in Mitzrayim. That's a good gift. Ma'at Dvash. So it's in Eretz Yisrael, but it's not in Eretz Mitzrayim. A final interesting point, which actually is based on the Meshech Chochma elsewhere, brings us to the episode of the Meraglim. When they went to Eretz Canaan, they brought back fruit, and they wanted to show people how outsized all the fruit was, to scare them or startle them or whatever it will be. And what fruit did they bring? They took Eshkol Anavim, they took a cluster of grapes, Umin Harimonim, Umin Hateinim. They took a pomegranate and a fig. Those three. Let's ask the Shaila. What about other fruits? I mean, this list is so recognizable to us. And once again, noticeably missing are dates and olives. Bring them back. Complete the complement. But based on what Meshech Chochma is saying, we can understand that those aren't things that would startle people. They have no idea what they're meant to look like. So how would they know if this is so much bigger? They've never seen them before. Because once again, these are things not available in Eretz Mitzrayim. And thus, based on all of this, says Meshech Chochma, al derech hapshat, this appears to be the reason for that generation why the shemen udvash, the olives and the dates, were in a mini list all of their own. They're a new category because they're unknown fruits heretofore to Bnei Yisrael. So that is a very interesting look at a pasuk with which we're very familiar, the Shiva Samin. Now, from here, I'd like to move from Perek Ches to Perek Tes. And again, just to consider al derech haparshanut, a couple of psukim. Pasuk Dalet and Pasuk He. Perek Tes, Pasuk Dalet, Pasuk He. We'll begin with Pasuk Dalet. What does Moshe say to Yisrael? These are words of, in a sense, admonition, as they are entering Eretz Canaan. Al toma b'vavcha. Do not say in your heart, meaning do not think, ba'adof Hashem elokecha osam milfanecha leimor. When Hashem gets rid of all of these nations before you, don't think, you know why this is happening, b'tzidkasiyah v'yane Hashem l'reshes as aretz hazos. It's because of my tzidkus. It's on account of my righteousness. That's why all this is happening. Uverishas hagoyim ha'ele, Hashem marisha mipanecha. And it's due to the wickedness, the evil of those nations. Don't say that, says Moshe Rabbeinu, because it's not true. What is true? It's not because of your righteousness. It's on account of their wickedness. And Hashem is keeping the promise he made to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Let us summarize what Moshe is saying that they shouldn't think, and what is the reality. What they shouldn't think is that the factors in play in them entering and dispossessing those currently in the land are A, their righteousness, and B, the wickedness of those nations. That's not the case. Rather, what is the case? The wickedness of those nations, plus Hashem keeping his promise. And when you think about it, it seems to be somewhat discordant. Because we don't seem to have what you could call davar behipucho. In other words, the rejected notion and the true notion. Because it happens to be that the true notion contains half of what the rejected notion has. As if to say, don't think that it's because of A and B. That's not true. You know what it's because of? B. Well, okay, I mean, we were half right, it sounds like. It's not an absolute rejection of that idea. So is that the case? I mean, is it so nuanced? Don't think that it's the two of them together. It's just the one. But at least that one, so 50% of what we said is correct. It's just we got it half right and half wrong. But it's not entirely wrong. It's an interesting Shiloh. Doesn't seem to be as binary as one might have expected. Before addressing this question, let us go back to the very first time the Jewish people were forecast to enter Eretz Canaan, and that, of course, is in Parshas Lech Lecha, in the Bris Ben Abesarim. That's when Avraham Avinu he's told about the goddess Mitzrayim and how it will be, Arba Meir Shana, so on and so forth, and then V'achrechein Yitzibu Chush Gadol. And the Bris Ben Abesarim continues, and they'll come back to the land of Canaan. V'dor Rivi'i Yoshuvu Hena. The fourth generation will return here. Now, firstly, of course, and we're not going to get so much into the details, that's more for Parshas Lech Lecha, how do you configure the fourth generation? When we see everything that happened, that's considered, that's time-stamped as generation four. That's a whole discussion, Rashi, Ramban, many Meforshim. But Tachlis, at the end of the day, by the time we came back, it's generation four, and we're ready to come in. But what's interesting is, we got delayed in the wilderness because of the Chet Meraglim. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says the fourth generation will come back. Apparently not before. Why not? Hashem explains. Ki lo shalem avon ha'emori adhena. Because the nation, the sin of the Emori, representing the indigenous seven nations, it's not full, which means they're not deserving of being dispossessed until that time, which means you can't come in, so to speak, on their cheshbon. You've got to wait until their lot is full, and they deserve to be dispossessed, then you can come in. And in the end, that's what happened. But of course, looking back historically, you have to wonder, well, what if the Meraglim hadn't happened? If the Meraglim hadn't happened, then we would have gone in 40 years earlier, and that seems to compromise the idea of only coming in the fourth generation. So how are we to work all of this out? And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh explains, this is in Parshas Lech Lecha, in our Parsha he has other explanations here, but in Parshas Lech Lecha, he explains that the matter is based on a very interesting discussion in Maseches Brachos, on Daf Zayin. The Gemara, I believe, is also elsewhere in the Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara comments on a pasuk, which talks about how the righteous fare in this world, how the wicked fare in this world. As we know, righteous don't always come first in this world. And the way that the pasuk refers to it is Kivala Rasha Tzadik Mimenu. Sometimes a Rasha can swallow up someone who's more of a tzadik than him. And that's the reality. And the Gemara sets parameters. Is that always true? It almost sounds like a Rasha will tend to come first. Is that always true? And the Gemara explains. There's two types of tzadik, and there's two types of Rasha. And it's very simple to break them down. You're either a complete tzaddik or incomplete tzaddik. A complete Rasha or an incomplete Rasha. Tzaddik gomor, someone who's perfectly righteous, however that's defined, but that's that level. And tzaddik she'eino gomor, he's a tzaddik, but not quite enough, not perfect, not full tzaddik. The same is true for a Rasha. It can be a Rasha, and then a Rasha gomor, complete Rasha. Says the Gemara, when you put these categories into the equation, you'll see how it works out. If the people involved are incomplete in their categories, meaning if an incomplete tzaddik comes up against an incomplete Rasha, so in such a situation, the Rasha will tend to win. Why? Because he has some credit. He's not a complete Rasha. He's got some credit, and his credit tends to be cashed in early for obvious reasons. And the tzaddik, if he's an incomplete tzaddik, he's got some demerits, they'll tend to follow him again in this world. And that's why you can expect that if they're both incomplete, so the minority merits of the incomplete Rasha will sometimes overcome the minority demerits of the incomplete tzaddik. But as soon, says the Gemara, as soon as one of them in the equation is completely in his category, so then it's all over. If you have a complete tzaddik, so there's no outstanding demerits, he will prevail even in this world. If you have a complete Rasha with no outstanding merits, he will always lose in this world. And therefore, Says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, we look at our history, and in the end, we had to wait 40 years. We had to wait 40 years because of the Meraglim. But the question, of course, is, and had we not done the Meraglim? It's too early. What about the sin of the Amori? It's not complete. The answer, says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, is that had we not sinned in the Meraglim, we wouldn't have needed their sin to be complete in order for us to enter, because we would have been in the category of Tzadik Gomor. We would have recovered from every other issue, and as a Tzadik Gomor, even if they are incomplete Rishayim, it doesn't matter. We would have entered. It's only as a result of the Chet HaMeraglim, now there should be no misunderstanding, even post-Meraglim, we're still doing better than the Amori in Eretz Canaan, but things have changed. Things have changed because post-Meraglim, we may be in the category of Tzadikim, but not Tzadikim Gemurim. Once that's true, if we go up against the Amori now, we are at risk. And under those circumstances, you need to wait until the lot of the Amori is full of sin, because at that point they will become complete Rasha'im, and at that point they exit. In other words, when Avraham Avinu was told, Dor Revi Yashuvu Heina, you've got to wait for the fourth generation, you've got to wait for the Amori sin to be full, that in a sense is, shall we say, the lowest common denominator, the worst case scenario, just like 400 years is the worst case scenario in Mitzrayim, in the end it didn't happen. That this is the final eventuality. Even if you're not complete tzaddikim, but you will come in when they become complete rishayim. And in the end, that's what happened. But without the Meraglim, we could have come in earlier as complete tzaddikim, even if they were not complete rishayim. And now, bearing all this in mind, although the variables, you have to keep them all, each one in its place, says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, that's why, back to our psukim, Pasuk Dalet, and Hey, when Moshe says to the Jewish people, don't think that it's that, because it's this, they really are two completely separate things. Because what you shouldn't think, says Moshe, and again to see the words in Pasuk Dalet, Al Tova Vavavcha, do not think, Badof Hashem Elokecha, Usam Mefanecha, Leimor, when Hashem dispossesses them, saying, you know why this is happening? It's because of me. I'm the primary component here, because I'm at Tzadik Gomor, completely righteous, and therefore I'm at Tzadik Gomor, and they're a Rasha, and they lose. They don't even have to be complete Rishayim to lose, because I'm a complete Tzadik. Says Moshe, that's sadly not true anymore. That's part of the new reality. No, lo b'tzidkasecha. It's not because of your tzidkus. You're Tzadikim, but not complete Tzadikim. That wouldn't be enough to carry the day. You know what it's about? Berishas Hagoyim Ma'ele. It's over their wickedness. And this is not the type of wickedness referred to in Pasuk Dalet. In Pasuk Dalet, they don't even need to be completely wicked in order to be dispossessed, because we're complete tzaddikim. That's not true. Pasuk Dalet refers to them as Risharim with a lowercase r. And that's not true. You know why? It's not because you're tzaddikim with a capital tzaddik. It's because they're Risharim with a capital resh. And that's what's carrying the day, because at that point, Shalem Avon Ha'emori. So these are some very interesting parshanot points with regards to Parshas Ekev. And from there, I'd like to move back to Parshas Devarim, or more correctly, to the Haftorah of Parshas Devarim, which is the Haftorah of Chazon. Chazon Yishayahu. And as we know, it's very prominent. The Shabbos is called Shabbos Chazon because of this Haftarah. And when we look at the Haftarah of Chazon Yishayahu, which is from the very beginning of Sefer Yishayahu, it wasn't his first Nevuah, but it's chapter 1, as we'll see, of Sefer Yishayahu. It's very difficult to say that it is all one thing, because it's multifaceted. Some of it is words of castigation and terrible rebuke from Yishayahu Hanavi, and some of it is very encouraging and comforting already there. At least exhorting to do well, and in the end things will be well. In fact, an astute Balkore, although the Haftorah for Eicha is read in the Chazon is read in the Eicha tune, But those psukim which are not tragic, but are actually positive psukim, should not be read in the Eicha tune. They should be read in the normal Haftorah tune. So one needs to, in a sense, stay alert. But it's really based, comprised of both. And that's important because we tend to generalize, and perhaps it's generally so, but it's never always so. We take, for example, Yeshaya. Yeshaya is the prophet of consolation. One gets the impression that he never says anything which is not words of consolation. And here he is, just before Tisha B'Av, giving the most withering rebuke. Chazon Yeshayahu is from Yeshaya. And the same is true, by the way, for Yirmiyahu, who is also, he's known really as a prophet of Peronos. I mean, he's foretelling destruction, etc. But if you read through Yirmiyahu, there's much comfort there. And there's much pleading on the part of the Jewish people, and there's much predictions of good times. The Haftarah for Yom Kippur is from Yirmiyahu. Rechama v'kavaneh, yesh tikva l'achriseh, v'shavu banim negvulam. That's Yirmiyahu talking. So the truth, as is often the case, is a little bit more blended than just a clear cut. He does this, and he does this. Back to Yeshayahu and the Torah of Chazon. Some of it is difficult, and some of it is, once again, very encouraging. In the end, you need both. The Baalei HaRemez actually take us to the very first word of the Haftarah, Chazon. Chazon Yeshayahu. Chazon has the four letters, Chet, Zayin, Vav, Nun. So the Baalei HaRemez, that's Rosh HaTevis, Chazon. Chetzio Zam, Vechetzio Nechama. Half of it is wrath, and half of it is comfort. And that's really what makes up the Haftarah of Chazon. But of course, ideally, although sometimes you need both, but Yeshayahu HaNavi, he doesn't want to be telling the Jewish people about their faults. He doesn't want to be predicting bad things for them. He wants to say only good things for them, but he has no choice. In fact, Rabbi Chaim Vital, and of course, Rabbi Chaim Vital is the famous disciple of the Arizal, and most of what we would ever hear from him or quote from him would be in the realms of Kabbalah and Nistar, etc. But there's a fascinating idea of Parshanut that comes out in the name of Rabbi Chaim Vital. I also saw it in the Droshas Bina Le'itim, Rabbi Azaria Feggio of Italy. And they take us back to, and again, to see how the Gedolim learn Navi, to the first Nevuah ever of Yeshayah, his first meeting, so to speak, is when he becomes a Navi. And it's not in Perek Aleph of Yeshayah, it's in Perek Vav. And it's actually the Haftorah for Parshas Yisro. Bishnas Mos Oziyahu, etc. That's where Kodesh, Kodesh, Kodesh comes in, all there. And there Yeshayahu says, I heard a voice, and this is Hashem's voice, saying, Es mi eshlach, who shall I send? Umi yelech lanu. And who will go on our behalf? And that's, of course, an invitation for Yeshayahu to respond. And he did. Va'omar, and I said, Hineni ani shlacheni. I'm here. Send me. And he becomes a Navi. So it's a very interesting situation. The invitation was thrown out. Who should we send? Who will go for us? Yeshayahu said, I'd like to go. And he did. But it's very interesting if we look closer at those words. So the invitation seems to be doubled up. Es mi eshlach, umi yelech lanu. Who shall I send? Who will go for us? Well, whoever goes on our behalf is basically the one you're sending. So that sounds like two ways of saying the same thing. So why is it divided into two? Es mi eshlach, umi yelech lanu. Another question is, the first phrase, Es mi eshlach, who shall I send? That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking. But the second phrase is the first person, plural. Umi yelech lanu, who should go for us? But if it's the same idea, so why is Hashem sending, but he's going for us? Who are we? And we note as well, that although HaKadosh Baruch Hu phrased it in two ways, Es mi eshlach, umi yelech lanu, when Yeshayahu responds, he says, Hineni ani, I'm here, shlacheini, send me. What about the second part? You should also say, shlacheini, send me, v'ani eleich lachem, and I'll go for you. I mean, the invitation was twofold, so the response should be twofold. But he seems only to have responded to half of the invitation. That's what happens when we consider the pasuk. But what does it mean? Says Reb Chaim Vital, the reason why the invitation was divided into two is because there's two types of nevuah. There are positive nevuahs and there are negative nevuahs. There are positive nevuahs telling of how things will be in the future, etc. But there's negative nevuahs to rebuke the Jewish people, to foretell disaster that may come. And these two, positive and negative, are reflected in the two phrases. Because we have a principle. Although evil exists in the world, and it exists in the world for a reason, but the Medrash says, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Meyached Shemo Al Hara'a. Hashem does not attach his name to evil. Meaning, to attach his name to evil, although everything emanates from Hashem, Yotzeor Uveri Choshech, but to attach his name to evil would imply primary significance to evil. And that's never true. Evil exists in order to be overcome, in order to be confronted, etc. It's never the ideal. And therefore, the first part of the invitation is Es Mi Eshlach. It's in the first person singular. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu talking, and he uses the expression Eshlach, because a Shaliach is like the person, is like the sender himself. Shlucha shel Adam Kamosa. And therefore, with regards to positive nevuah, Hashem says, who shall I send? He doesn't need anyone else to send. These are positive things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is personally, so to speak, involved. And the Navi is his shaliach, kamosa. But then there's also negative nevuahs which need to be said. How are they expressed? Mi yelech lanu. There's no longer talk of a shaliach, because you don't represent in the same way. You don't identify with your sender in the same way. It's not shlichus, a negative nevuah. And moreover, it shifts to the plural. Why? Because now HaKadosh Baruch Hu has detached himself from personal association. It's more what's known as Bez Din Shel Mala. These are the way that the world runs, the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu has set it up. When you prophesy for the bad, you're not Hashem Shaliach. You're going on their behalf. And who's they? Bez Din Shel Mala. That's the invitation. And what does Yeshaya says? I'd like the first one and not the second one. Hineni ani, shalcheini, send me, but I don't want to go for you. Because I only want to say the nevuahs to the Jewish people that are a shaliach on your behalf. I want to comfort them and point out their good qualities, and that's the only thing that he accepted. However, the reality is that the Jewish people need both, or are liable to need both. Because if they've lost their way, or if there are things that need to be corrected, and they're never corrected, and they're just sung lullabies the whole time, so then the result will be worse. They'll never recover. And thus we find that the success of the Jewish people and the downfall of the Jewish people are much closer than we might think. But they're all part of their destiny as the Jewish people, and sometimes they even partake of the same quality and derive from the same characteristic. It's fair to say that with regards to the Churban and Tisha B'Av, etc., a motif word is the word Eicha. That's how the Megillah starts. Eicha, the Eicha of Yirmiyah. But Yirmiyah was not the first prophet to say Eicha. He was actually the third. He was preceded by Yeshayahu HaNavi again, and they were both preceded by Moshe Rabbeinu. The very first Eicha in history, in Torah recorded history, is in this week's Parsha. When Moshe says, it's in the beginning of Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud, Yud Aleph, Eicha Esalavadi, Tochachem, Umasachem, Vrivachem, how can I deal by myself and bear by alone all of your contentiousness and all of your burdens, etc., and your troubles? That's the first Eicha. The second Eicha, and interestingly, that's Minag Yisrael. I don't know if it's a halacha. I wouldn't send the Balkari back, but the Minag is that Eicha in this week's Parsha is said in the June of Eicha. In fact, for that reason, Sheni starts a pasuk earlier on Shabbos. During the week, the first 10 psukim are read. But pasuk Yud Aleph is Eicha. And therefore on Shabbos, we actually stop after 9 psukim, so that Sheni shouldn't start with Eicha. Start with a nice one. Shem Elokeichem, Ribayeschem, etc., and then move into Eicha. So it's said in the Eicha tune, the second Eicha in our history is from the Haftarah, back to Chazon Yeshayahu. And Yeshayahu says, and again, for all of our, the way that we normally associate Yeshayahu, he says what needs to be said. Eicha Yisod Zona Kirya Ne'emana, how could it be such a trustworthy place? It's become like harlots. They've betrayed their identity. It's a very harsh Eicha. The third and final Eicha is the Eicha of Yirmiyahu, Eicha Yeshva Badad, and all the other Eichas in Megillas Eicha. But what's interesting is, of those three Eichas, the first one is not necessarily negative at all. It's just Moshe saying, there's so many of you, I can't take care of you all by myself. That's not a bad thing. It's good. In fact, if we take a look at the Psukim, there's a fascinating comment of the Meshech Chochma in Perek Aleph, back to Devarim. If we see Pasuk Tes, Va'omar Lechem, I said to you at that time, Ba'eseh Lemor, at that time saying, I can't handle you by myself, I can't carry you by myself. Moving into Yudbeis, Eicha Esal Levadi, Tochachem, and how can I deal with all of your burdens and etc., all of your issues. So it sounds like on a simple level, Moshe is saying it's too much and you just need to know that it's too much. But Meshech Chochma comes in and he takes us back to Pasuk Tes. One of the most overlooked words in the Chumash is the word Lemor. We neutralize it almost just by translating it as saying. Yedaber Hashem and Moshe Lemor. What does Lemor mean? Saying. What does that mean? Nothing. Because you can't have it by itself. It's got to follow Vayidaber or Vayomer, and that's the speaking, and that's the saying. So what then does Lemor mean? It's a very interesting shaila. It's one of the most glossed over words in the Chumash. But the truth is that grammatically, Lemor is an infinitive. It means to say. Which means many Mefarshim explain, Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemor means Hashem spoke to Moshe to say. That he should say it over. So with that in mind, go back to Pasuk Tes. Va'omar lechem ba'esei le'mor. I said to you, say to le'mor, to say, lo chalav adil ha'seis eschem, culminating in Eicha, how can I handle all of you? But the question is, this is Moshe talking to the Jewish people. Why is he telling them to say this to anyone else? Why is this message Lemor? Something that's to be said. And to be said to whom? To each other? Moshe talking to all of them. And Meshech Chochma gives a mashal of someone, he's got a large business and a large family, and he doesn't have a spare minute. There's always one thing, he's got to take care of things the whole time, and he's run up his feet. And the time comes for him to give his children a bracha. What do you think he'll say to them? You know what he'll say, says Meshech Chochma? I hope you have all the problems that I have. Because these are rich man's problems. It's good to be busy. It's good to be run off your feet. Because that means there's a lot going on. These are the problems, quote unquote, of success. And that's really what Moshe is saying. He's not just recalling, I said there were too many of you, how can I take care of you? He gave them a bracha. And he says, Lemor, I hope you always say this. I hope that you, when the time comes, your leaders will always look at the Jewish people and say, there's so many of you, how can I take care of all of you? Because that's a rich man's problem. So the first Eicha is a bracha, which kind of makes you wonder why it's read in such a mournful tune. But the answer says, Maharal, in the Sefer Netzach Yisrael, is because there's something about the word Eicha that it can be used as a blessing, but it can very easily become something else. Because Eicha is an exclamation when a person just can't get over something. He's overwhelmed. Eicha, how can it be? Now, you could be overwhelmed by something positive or negative. But the Jewish people are always overwhelming. They have a certain quality about them. They're always full of energy. They're always full of talent. Something is always happening with them. It is a very powerful quality. And it could be the source of their greatest blessing or their worst downfall. It's the same quality. Because if they channel it correctly, there's no one like them. And if they channel it incorrectly, lo aleinu, there's no one like them. But it's the same idea. And that's why, although Moshe says it, and this really is part of his bracha, as if to say, I hope all your eichas, because you're always going to look at the Jewish people and say eicha. They're always going to be remarkable. I hope people always remark about you in a positive way. That's my bracha to you. It should always be the eicha that I'm saying. We don't want to hear other types of eichas. But that means that it's already said in the Eicha Tshuva because history bore out that the Jewish people didn't always use this quality in the right way. And sometimes it led them to the disaster that Yeshaya said his Eicha about. And then to the calamity that Yirmiyah said his Eicha about. It's the same word because it's the same characteristic. One could almost say that the goal of the Jewish people is to reclaim the Eicha of Moshe Rabbeinu. As if to say, when we're looking to move from Golus to Geula, there'll always be an Eicha. There'll always be issues, but we want them to be rich man's issues. We want them to be the problems of success to get back to the Eicha of Moshe. But there is a further Nakuda here. Here we are saying that history of the Jewish people, it's very complex. And their success and their failure are often somewhat intertwined. And even when they're doing very well, you have to keep an eye on them. But even if they're not doing well, you still need to see something, some special quality of the Jewish people, even in their time of disaster. There's a very interesting shaila, which some people raise. I'm not sure that it occurs to most people or everyone when we read Megillas Eicha. But Eicha is full of lament. It's lamentations. And it's written by Yirmiyahu HaNavi, much of it before the Churban, some of it afterwards. And it's in Ksuvim. If it's in Ksuvim, then that means that it's written Beruach HaKodesh. That's what the difference in Nevi'im and Ksuvim, although we can't go into the categories in detail now. Nevi'im is written B'Nevuah, Ksuvim is Beruach HaKodesh. Okay. So some Mefarshim ask an interesting shaila. There is a principle, the Gemara states it, it's a well-known idea, the Gemara in Shabbos and Daf Lamed Aleph. Ein Hashchina Shora Ela Bitoch Simcha. The divine presence only rests on a person when they are in a state of simcha, of joy. So the shaila is, how can Yirmiyahu HaNavi ever write Eicha with Ruach HaKodesh? The things that he's talking about, if he's happy, that's a problem. Because that's not appropriate. And if he's sad, so then he can't have Ruach HaKodesh. Is there a time lag? How does it work? It's an interesting shaila. But the Mefarshim explain, and it's a very deep idea. Although we have our own impressions of what simcha is, certainly we know there are many understandings of what happiness is, which are completely off the mark. But at the end of the day, the deepest happiness is a person who is connected to their purpose and their meaning, and their own personal destiny, and the destiny of their people. And that doesn't always bring with it pleasant experiences. But the alternative is worse. Because the Jewish people are Hashem's people. And if they take a wrong turn, they need to be corrected. And if they're persistent and obstinate, which the Jewish people have known to be, so they might need to be corrected in a harsher way. And that's where the simcha lies. Because the alternative is for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, lo rotze, lo rotze, you want to take a wrong turn, good luck to you. That is the worst case scenario. And therefore, as much as the Megillah of Eicha, it is a depiction of tragedy, but the underlying theme that runs through all of it is an understanding of where this tragedy is meant to lead the Jewish people. And that's how it ends. Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuva. It's all meant to lead the Jewish people back. V'yesh tikva la'achar yiseich. And because that's so, says Yirmiyo, I'm not happy the Jewish people are suffering with you. I'm much happier that this is happening than for them what? To dissolve? To disappear, to miss their unique destiny and the levels that they're capable of achieving and the status they're capable of enjoying. And that's how Eicha was written, Ruach HaKodesh. And it's for this reason that and the Jewish people are funny in this way, because as we know, Tisha B'Av is dark, dark day, and we don't say Tachnun. And no one's going anywhere. We don't say Tachnun. You almost feel like we've run out of pessimism. We don't have any left. So why say Tachnun? But we know that we don't say Tachnun on Tisha B'Av because it's called a Moed. Kara Alay Moed Lishmor Bachurai. A Moed is a Yom Tov. And you don't say Tachnun on Yom Tov. Now if you look at that pasuk, it doesn't sound very Yom Tov dick. Because it says, Kora alai mo'ed lishmor b'acharei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, set aside a time to break my young men. That doesn't sound like a Yom Tov. It doesn't sound like the other Yomim Tovim. And here we are, and we say, oh, Moed, no Tachnun. What does it mean? But the truth is that the word Moed comes from the word Lehiva'ed, to meet. Like Oel Moed, tent of meeting. What's special about a Moed is it's a time of meeting. It's a special day where we meet with Hashem. And when you do that, there's a certain connection and Tachnun just falls away. But the meeting isn't always about pleasant things. It depends how the Jewish people are going. But it is a Moed in that respect, no less than any other of the Yomim Tovim, because you come into direct confrontation with how are the Jewish people doing? And if they're not doing well, and they could be doing better, so you recognize that. And the alternative is never to ask that question, never to be called into a meeting about that. That's worse. That means you're out. And so it's a Moed. A lot of what happens on Tisha B'Av is about the fact that we're still connected. And not only that, but through all the difficulties, they're difficult because of the connection. Because if we're disconnected, there'll be nothing. Rav Pinchas of Koritz, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, so he said a very penetrating insight. As we know, and it's strange to see, Tisha B'Av morning, unless the things change, at Tisha B'Av morning, people turn up to shul, no tefillin. It's disorientating. Everyone just turns up. And they're not wearing Shabbos clothes. They're wearing weekday clothes. And it's the morning, and it's hard to get used to it. In the afternoon, things mellow a little bit, to some degree. People tefillin in the afternoon, but not in the morning. And the reason is because of Avelus. Rav Pinchas of Karet says, the reason why people don't wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av morning is because, what are they doing? Saying kinnus. So their kinnus or their tefillin for Tisha B'Av morning. And what does that mean? Kinnus and tefillin is not the same thing. But ultimately, they are the same thing. Because tefillin is about our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Kesher tefillin. And on a normal day, you wear tefillin, that's what it means. But isn't it true that there are certain days where we don't wear tefillin because the day connects you? Shabbos and Yom Tov, no tefillin, what happened? Ki osi, bein b'nei Yisrael, and Yom Tov, etc. And Tisha B'Av is a day like that. But what is it about the day that connects you? It's the kinnus. And why? Because when we connect with what the day is about, we reconnect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We prefer to connect in other ways, but it is a connection that renders for those hours tefillin are not necessary. This is the sign between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael. The fact that they're upset that they're not doing as well as they could be as his people. It's a very different perspective on what happens in Tisha B'Av. For this year especially, because the fast this year, again, if nothing changes, the fast this year will be on the 10th of Av, not the 9th. 9th is Shabbos. And on Shabbos, there's Tisha B'Av. Now, of course, you can't fast on Tisha B'Av. It's not like Yom Kippur. So you can't fast on Shabbos if it's Tisha B'Av Shabbos. But the truth is that we don't really do anything that's Tisha B'Av like in that way, apart from the Haftarah of Chazon, but the mood of the day, we eat meat, we drink wine. There's no Avelus on Shabbos. And the simple reason is, again, because Shabbos is a day that it overrides feelings of Avelus. But the Shaloh HaKadosh has a completely different approach to this. The Shaloh says, you know what? There's no Avelus on Shabbos over the Beis HaMikdash. Because the Gemara says, if a person mourns the Churban, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and everything that has ensued from there, which is all rooted in the Churban, such a person will be zochet to see the Geula. And the reason why is because that Avelus itself is what brings things forward. It prepares the groundwork for the future Geula, ultimately for the Beis HaMikdash. Says the Shalah Kodosh. What does that mean? It means Avelus, if one could say, this is a radical thing to say, Avelus that happens on Tisha B'Av for the Beis HaMikdash is constructive Avelus. It is a first act of rebuilding, and building is Osir on Shabbos. Shalah Kodosh says, you know what, why Avelus doesn't happen on Shabbos? Midin Bona. You can't build on Shabbos. You can't build on Shabbos. You can't dig foundations either. Because that's what happens when you're sitting on the floor. You're digging foundations. You can't do that on Shabbos. And it's for this reason that we look forward to these days, as the Navi Zechariah says. All those, Tzom HaMishi, Tzom Ravi, Tzom HaMishi, Shvi and Asiri, those 4 days of mourning for the Beis HaMikdash. In the future, they'll become Yomim Tovim. That's very nice. But let's ask the Shaila, why should they become Yom Tov? As if to say, you know what, let's just call it even. As if to say, they were mourning for when they were, that's all done. Let's just leave it alone. Let bygones be bygones. Let them just become like normal days again. Why do they become Yomim Tovim? They'll become Yomim Tovim because those are the days that will bring the Geula. They are preparing the Geula, and as such, they have a Yom Tov quality. Not yet. We're still in the digging stage, but in the future, when the Geula comes, we'll say, where did this come from? We'll look back, and the answer will be those days, those 4 days in the year. They brought this, that's Yom Tov. They'll become Yom Tovim. And so, it's not an easy day that's ahead of us, and it's not meant to be an easy day. But I think the more we see that this, as long as we're in Golos waiting for Geula, the role that this plays in it, I think, should give a completely different perspective. And in Mitzvah Hashem, we look forward to the time when all of these days, and Tisha B'Av more than any of them, should become a Yom Tov. But there's a famous bracha they give. I think it's just before Purim. It's like this year-round bracha of a Freilich of Purim, and a Kasher of Pesach, and a Milchike Shavuos, and a Fleishike Tisha B'Av. That's the bracha. So that should happen. Mitzvah Hashem, b'meher b'yameinu. Until it happens, plenty to be done. We'll leave it over here for this evening.